welcome to Culturetopia, NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Neda Ulubi. This week on Culturetopia, George Lucas has a new action movie about the real-life African-Americans who fought as pilots during World War II. The screenwriter of Red Tails, John Ridley, talks about the movie. Then, the economics behind the pop charts. How much money does it really cost to produce a hit? And actor Christian Bale, who's moved from playing Batman to a Dust Bowl refugee caught in the Nanking Massacre in his new movie, The Flowers of War. But first,
it took George Lucas more than two decades to bring to the screen the new movie Red Tails. Back in the late 80s, the man behind Star Wars and Indiana Jones fell under the spell of another story of adventure, this one with real-life heroes, the black fighter pilots of World War II.
Congratulations, Captain! You are the first Negro to shoot down a Jerry!
The Black Flyers, known as the Tuskegee Airmen, were as dashing, inventive, and brave as Indiana Jones. But they also carried the burden of the unrelenting racism of their day. In an act of defiance and pride, the Flyers painted the tails of their planes red and thus became known as the Red Tail Angels. John Ridley wrote the screenplay for Red Tails, and he joined us here at NPR West to talk about it. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Renee.
John, when we first meet these Black Flyers on their base in Italy, a segregated base, I might add, an all-black
right.
base, one of the guys says of their planes that they were plucked from Uncle Sam's junkyard.
Yeah, when the Flyers, the Tuskegee Airmen, were finally assigned overseas duties in Italy, they were given P-40s, which were, you know, that old saying that you go to war not with the weapons that you wish you had, you go to the war with the weapons that you have. And that was the situation with the Tuskegee Airmen. They weren't given very good assignments. They weren't given very good material. They weren't expected to do anything at all. And, of course, their history proved that they exceeded all expectations.
Well, before we get on to what was really an experiment in whether black men in uniform, in bomber jackets, you know, could actually fly planes and fight in a war, let's talk about the characters. They were all black, but they could have come out of a John Wayne movie, your characters. But pipe-smoking major, a hot-headed troublemaker.
Yeah, you know, when I had an opportunity to sit down and talk with these Tuskegee Airmen, and this was obviously, you know, this was 60 years on from the war, you know, these guys were all, despite the fact they were in their 70s, their 80s, they were real characters. I mean, there's something about young men in airplanes that what it takes to get up in the air, and particularly in these days, I mean, this was before electronics. Back in the day, you basically had a propeller and a stick, and you were getting in the air. And whatever it took, besides trying to prove that you could do it as a black man in America, whatever it took to get in an airplane, these guys still had it. And when you sit with them, they're the same characters. You know, if a guy was chewing tobacco back in the day, he was chewing tobacco now. If he was full of braggadocio back in the day, he had it now. And that's what we want to do with these characters, is not just make them these quiet, stoic black men who are trying to fight for the right to fight. These guys were exciting.
And in the movie, as in real life, they started out with, as they put it, you know, junk.
Right.
And they ended up with state-of-the-art, these beautiful planes. In all of these planes, these guys could do anything.
Well, the interesting thing about the Tuskegee Airmen, once they started fighting, they were given the finest planes at that time, which were the P-51 Mustangs. I mean, these were the Corvettes of the air. A lot of officers, once the Red Tails got into the air, they were astounded at how much better, and I put that word in quotes, better they were than the white pilots. The thing is that they weren't innately better, but they had trained so much longer because no one wanted to assign them. So when they got the opportunity, they were among the most trained pilots in the air, and they proved themselves immediately.
Super disciplined, and I think it's worth talking about a key combat mission that they were given, something that really happened historically,
right,
to escort bomber planes to their targets, and they called them the heavies. They were the big, fat bomber
right.
planes. Let's just play a clip here.
We count our victories by the bombers we get to their targets, by the husbands we return to their wives, by the fathers we get back to their children. From the last plane to the last bullet to the last minute to the last man we fight, we fight.
Yes, sir.
Now, this could be a pep talk from an officer to his men in just about any war film. But in this case, we're talking a black officer challenging his men to protect white pilots,
right,
many of whom were disdainful of their protectors.
Yeah, the interesting thing about what happened was you have to understand the format of the war at that time. These B-17s, the large planes, the heavies, as you call them, they would have about 10 or 11 men on board. They would have these bomber trains of maybe 100 B-17s. You're talking about 1,000 men in the air. And at the time, they were losing 20, 30, 40 of these bombers per mission. So you're talking about thousands of men on a mission. You can imagine what that was doing to the psyche at the time on the home front, losing this many men. And part of the reason was because originally the pilots were trained, the white pilots were trained, go after the German jet fighters, chase them down, leaving the bombers exposed. Other German planes would come in behind and shoot down these bombers. The Tuskegee Airmen, the Red Tails, were specifically told, do not chase the plane. Don't chase glory going after the German fighters. Stay with the bombers. It was a big deal. It was huge. Different way of fighting changed the course of the war. It really did.
What was it like, though, for you writing a script for a movie that George Lucas had a Lucas vision for? I mean, how do you balance portraying this tale of triumph over racism, pretty serious stuff, and at the same time telling an old-fashioned story of patriotism and adventure that a 12-year-old boy would love?
Well, I have to say, honestly, it was great on a lot of levels. One, because George this was a passion project for him, so he really took the reins off. A lot of times when you work with the studios, for all kinds of reasons, you have constraints. You have budgetary constraints or what's in their pipeline, what they need. George was, go do this. And for me, one of the really great things, Renee, you talk about what it's like writing a film that a 12-year-old boy would like. When I started writing this, my son was 7. And when I got the material for Red Tails, some of it was on DVD and old war films and things like that. And my son, you know, he would see me playing these on the DVD and he would get interested what this was about and all this. And I said to him, if you want to watch these old war films, do it. So he went off and watched them and he came back to me and he said, oh, Daddy, I have this really great idea for how the movie should end. And so, and I don't want to spoil anything, but my son actually came up with what should be the end of the film. So it wasn't just a concept. It really was an opportunity for me. And personally, one of the things I really enjoy about this film was to be able to, even in the slightest way, do something with my son. It was the greatest moment of my life, going to the premiere with my son, being able to point to the screen and go, you know, that's something you helped your dad do. That was fantastic.
John Ridley wrote the screenplay for the new George Lucas movie about the black airmen of World War II, Red Tails. He is, of course, also a commentator, longtime commentator here on Morning Edition. Thanks very much, John, for talking.
As always, Renee, thanks for having me.
Christian Bale plays a drifter in his new film. John Miller is no Batman. He's an Oklahoma mortician by trade and a soldier of fortune and temperament. He comes to do a bit of business in Nanjing, formerly known as Nanking, China, in 1937, just as the Japanese army invades and brutalizes the city.
American. From the refuge?
Me?
American.
America?
Not soldier.
Ah!
Huh?
Go ahead.
The Nanjing Massacre is one of the defining historical events of modern China. Women were particular victims of war crimes there, and in Christian Bale's new film, The Flowers of War, an unlikely group of women are also heroes, and his character discovers a sense of purpose. The film was China's Oscar nominee for Best Foreign Language Film. It was made for a reported $100 million by the director Zhang Yimou. Christian Bale, who is perhaps best known for playing Batman, and of course won an Academy Award last year for The Fighter, joins us from Beverly Hills, California. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
In a sense, is this role a return to China for you?
I didn't feel like that. You know, I mean, you're talking about when I was 13, I made Empire of the Sun in Shanghai.
Right, with Steven Spielberg.
Back in 1987, yeah. But that feels like such another lifetime to me. And I was very interested to work with Zhang Yimou, who's a phenomenally accomplished director. And it's not very often that you get an opportunity to work on a movie that's, 60% in Mandarin, made within China, and get to experience that entirely different culture of filmmaking.
I have to ask, Mr. Bale, how do you react to the charge some reviewers and people in the film industry have made that this this whole huge expensive film was kind of a part of a Chinese government effort to soften its image?
I think that For me, obviously, I had no interest in making a movie with that in mind whatsoever. I always do say that, once you're within a movie, it's a little hard. Sometimes you can't see the wood for the trees. But I've really assessed this one, and I can't bring myself to come to agree with it in any way whatsoever. And knowing Emo, I do not think that he would ever have any interest in entertaining that at all.
What was it like to work on such a huge set with so many people who were probably making their first film?
I like that. I always like working with people making their first film. You know, there's that enthusiasm, there's that naivety about it. You know that nobody's got a bag of tricks that they're falling back on. And I found that with Emo, he never told anybody what we were going to be shooting until very late the night before. And it just gives that extra spontaneity. And I like that kind of filmmaking. It's far more human.
How does your character, John Miller, this Dust Bowl drifter, wind up at the center of the story?
I kind of viewed him as an escapee from the Dust Bowl. He's kind of a jack of all trades, was mechanically inclined as well. And he does have a past history, which we come to learn about later in the movie. He finds himself, kind of exhausting all possibilities within America and then ends up working on cargo ships. And he's kind of a character who is accustomed to raucous and chaotic people around him. That's what he likes. That's where he finds his comfort. He's definitely pursuing excess with a vengeance as a means, we find out later, to deal with pain. And then finds himself stuck within the confines of a Catholic church with some other unlikely guests in the midst of the massacre in Nanking.
Yeah, we'll explain. Half the people, aside from John Miller, half the people being sheltered there are convent schoolgirls, and half are, what term of art should I use, streetwalkers.
Streetwalkers, prostitutes, courtesans, they are an unlikely mix, and definitely creates a storm within this church, whilst this far more horrific storm is raging outside.
Let's play a clip, if we could. John Miller and his, I think we could safely say, favorite among the women, Mo, played by Nini, unveils her plans to make John Miller their ticket out of Nanjing.
I want you to take us out of Nanking.
Huh? Yeah. Right. You do this first.
I'm serious. What else do you think we're flirting with you?
Out of Nanking. How?
I don't know how, but I know your face is the way out of here. The Japanese won't touch Westerners.
And in what you're hearing there, he's looking for a different kind of business transaction altogether with Nini's character. And then she's using that as leverage for him as a Westerner, that he could help her. There was this international zone set up by Westerners, by John Rabe primarily, and incredible people, Minnie Votrin, and there was a missionary called John McGee as well. And these people, it's estimated, were responsible for saving up to 200, 250,000 lives. And so the locals very much saw that a Western face was the key to escape from the city.
We're talking about this drifter, John Miller, who is unexpectedly cast into this role of a priest. What do you think got to your character that made him rise to the occasion?
So he appears to be an absolute, reckless, drunken, good time guy who cares nothing about anybody but just making a quick buck for himself and moving on. And that's indeed how he would be thinking of this war to start with, that it would just be a tale that he could tell over some beers with some buddies back in the States or wherever the hell he's going to wind up around the world. And it means nothing to him, but eventually it comes to be his own war.
I'm looking for two women. They got shiny dresses. I need to find them. They're in trouble.
Why are you dressed like this? What is this?
I got drunk. I woke up. I was just dressed as a priest.
Who is this?
This is George. This is George. Have you seen them?
Seen who?
The women.
There's women piled up all over the street.
You haven't seen them?
No, I haven't seen any women, no. You think it's safe to be looking for women right now?
Can you help me with tools?
Tools for what?
I gotta fix a truck.
Fix a truck for what?
I gotta help George. I gotta help some girls.
Yeah,
I gotta help
sake.
Some women, the prostitutes, and I gotta help them.
What are you kidding
Can
me?
You
You're talking
tools?
About prostitutes and trucks and tools? I'm talking about not dying in China. I'm leaving right now.
You're leaving Nanking right now?
Do you want to go? There's a boat. It's waiting for us. I'm leaving right now. If you want to go, then let's go. It's your last chance.
I gotta find them. I can't leave.
There was one young boy called George in the movie, such a wonderful actor, and then the convent girls. Really, the main character of the piece is a young character called Shu, and the whole movie is told through her eyes. And I arrived, and I met these girls, and they all had tears coming down their cheeks. And I thought, oh, okay, they're in the middle of a scene. I won't disturb them too much. And I saw they did a scene, and then a couple of days later, I saw them again, and they were crying again. And then every time I saw them, they were crying, and I was thinking, this is appalling. Like this, I know how much it takes out of somebody, how exhausting it is when you're in that state. And I was trying to work out, how on earth are they maintaining this all the time? And I was starting to think these girls are going to get sick. And then what was fantastic, it was a real ray of light, was one of them at one point, she sees me looking at them and just looking concerned, but I'm not quite sure what the hell to do. And she looks up and she winks and smiles. And they're just fantastic actresses. And they can cry their eyes out and keep you fooled. And all the time they're telling jokes with each other. And then as soon as Emo would walk by, they'd start crying again, and then as soon as he would gone, they'd make little jokes, and then, but they were better actors than I will ever be able to be.
What is fun about acting?
I think that there's something that seems to be in every single child, where there is an enjoyment of role-playing. And I love the psychology of recognizing how different you can make yourself. And I just find the whole notion that as adults we get to be storytellers just hilarious, but something that I would never want to miss out on.
Christian Bale, his new film, The Flowers of War, speaking from Beverly Hills. Mr. Bale, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Publishers and booksellers are worried that Amazon is going to devour their industry. The online retailer seems to have its hands in all aspects of the business now, from selling books to publishing them. And that has people wondering if there is any end to Amazon's influence, as NPR's Lynn Neary reports.
Publishers have a problem when it comes to discussing Amazon. They may fear its power, but they're also dependent on it, because like it or not, Amazon sells a lot of books. But lately, the grumbling about Amazon has been getting louder, with some in the book industry openly describing Amazon's tactics as predatory.
Well, certainly the word predator is pretty strong, and I don't use it loosely, but I should also mention that up until probably a few months ago, I've been one of Amazon's biggest fanatics.
Joe Weichert is general manager and publisher at O'Reilly Media. For a long time, publishers have been complaining about Amazon's pricing policies. They sold ebooks at cut-rate prices in order to win customers for the Kindle. And now, says Weichert, they're undercutting their competitors by selling e-readers, like the new Kindle Fire, at a loss.
And I could have sworn at one point we had laws against predatory pricing. And I just don't understand why that's not an issue, because that's got to be hurting other device makers out there in trying to capture part of this market.
But Weichert's also well aware that Amazon has made life very convenient for consumers.
Amazon has built a one-click model, and I do it all the time, where it's so simple and easy for me to get a sample or just to buy the book outright. I know that there are other options out there, but it requires several extra steps that you have to go through, and that's what's really kind of challenging.
Just before Christmas, Amazon infuriated booksellers with its Price Check app, which allowed customers to check out prices in brick-and-mortar stores, then get a discount if they bought from Amazon. Dennis Johnson of Melville House Publishing has long been a vocal critic of Amazon.
I feel that in the book industry, which is a very timid industry, that was the thing that really got people saying, you know, it's time for us to stand up to this and try to do something.
Melville House Publishing is trying to develop a number of things to help booksellers. One of them is the Shelf Talker, a digital display which helps customers browse through print books in a brick-and-mortar store, but buy e-books from that store's website instead of from Amazon.
They can just whip out their smartphone, scan the code on whatever the display item is. They're magically, immediately at the store's website, and they can buy the book within moments.
But such devices bear no small resemblance to the slingshot David used against Goliath. Johnson would prefer to see Amazon investigated for antitrust violations, but he's not expecting that will happen anytime soon. And recently he got more evidence of just how many tentacles Amazon has in the book world when none other than beloved librarian Nancy Pearl, Morning Edition commentator and darling of independent bookstores, struck a deal with Amazon.
You know, I work in an open office, and one of my staffers saw that online, and I heard him say, wow, and then he read it out to us in the office, and we all just kind of sat there quietly. trying to take it in because it was such a surprise.
Amazon has agreed to publish at least a dozen of Nancy Pearl's favorite novels, which had been out of print. Pearl will provide an introduction, book discussion questions, and suggestions for further reading. Pearl says much of the reaction to the news has been positive, but not all of it.
There's been pushback that I've gone over to the dark side and allied myself with these people who are destroying the book business as we know it.
The venture, called Book Lust Rediscoveries, is something Pearl has wanted to do for years. She had reservations about going with Amazon, but says she shopped it to other publishers who didn't pick it up.
Amazon just blew me, my agent, both of us away with their enthusiasm for doing something so wonderful as resurrecting books that never should have gone out of print in the first place.
So add a curatorial role to Amazon's Hydra-like book business. It makes it just that much harder, says Dennis Johnson, to cut the behemoth down to size.
I mean, it's on so many fronts. As I say, librarians feel like they're under assault by them. Booksellers feel like they're under assault by them. Publishers feel like they're under assault by them. And in each instance, they are.
Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
Katy Perry. In 2011, the pop singer was the most played artist on the radio. She went number one 5 times, and her album Teenage Dream was massively popular. Strangely, in the record industry, it's hard to know if this kind of success translates into huge amounts of money. Zoe Chase of NPR's Planet Money team tries to answer that question, how much a label can make by sending an artist to the top of the charts.
This would seem like a simple question. So I walked over to Katy Perry's record label in Manhattan. She's on Capitol, which is under EMI. I met Greg Thompson, a record exec, and I asked.
I know it was an expensive record and pushing out the singles was expensive. Did you guys end up in the black? Did you recoup?
As far as I know, yes.
Let's just pause for a second here. Katy Perry, number one artist by all these measures, and the exec at her label isn't sure?
How do you not know?
No, I believe we did. Absolutely.
It's actually complicated, and it's also something the record labels don't like to talk about. EMI wouldn't show me the numbers, so I decided to do some back-of-the-envelope calculations and figure out for myself. There's two things we need to know. How much did they bring in, and how much did it cost?
You know, we invested substantially to make a great record.
What does substantially mean? I called up Andy Tavel. He's an entertainment lawyer. He's had clients like Mary J. Blige and The Cure. First expense, the album itself. How much did it cost to record Teenage Dream?
$1.5 million to up, perhaps even up to $2 million.
Why so expensive? Look at this track.
Greetings, loved ones. Let's take a journey.
That's Snoop Dogg. He's pricey. And the production underneath? That's the sound of the top producers in the business, Dr. Luke and Max Martin. They charge about $100,000 each track, according to Tavel. 12 songs on the album, it starts to add up. On top of this, there's Katy Perry's advance.
That advance could have been perhaps $1 million net, perhaps $2 million. I can't say for certain.
That's $1.5 million in recording costs, plus a $1 million advance, $2.5 million shelled out by the record company before anyone's heard the album. Remember, a song is not a hit song unless you hear it everywhere.
New York's new hit music channel.
This is our next expense. Andy Tavel says it could cost up to $250,000 just to get the first single played on radio. Special promotions, free merchandise, and presents. I walked into Rob Wagman's office. He's a program director at a top 40 station. There was a painting of Katy Perry on the wall. She's naked, wrapped in a cloud of cotton candy.
They usually send that out before the next single.
The Katy Perry songs also tested well, and top 40 played them. So, a boatload of money goes to Katy. Thousands of dollars to people like Snoop, the producers, the radio. Around $4 million in costs is our estimate. Now, how would they make it back? What we do know is what Katy Perry sold in the United States. 2 million albums, 25 million digital tracks. And EMI, the record label, only makes pennies on the dollar. Here's EMI exec Greg Thompson again.
Being in the business of pennies at the large scale can actually be a good business.
Let's say you buy The One That Got Away, that's the sixth single, off iTunes for 99 cents. 30% off the top goes to Apple. 15 cents goes to the songwriters who wrote lines like this.
And I
and Katy Perry gets a cut of the songwriting credit for adding lines like this. The label gets the rest. By our estimate, the record-shattering, top-charting Katy Perry made her label around $8 million in music sales in the U.S. That's not even counting revenue from movie trailers or commercials or overseas sales. But the record industry's in trouble, right?
The problem is that her batting average isn't high enough, that those success stories like Katy Perry are unfortunately too few and far between.
EMI needs a whole roster of Katy Perrys to make money hand over fist the way they used to. But they hit it out of the park with this one. Zoe Chace, NPR News, New York. Summer after high school when we first met. We make out in your Mustang to
Radiohead. That song is called The East is Red, and it was China's de facto national anthem during the Cultural Revolution. From about 1966 to 1976, China's leader Mao Zedong enforced a brutal agenda. Everything was rationed. Millions of people were forced out of the cities and into the countryside, where food was even more scarce. The government controlled people's movements, their livelihoods, even their thoughts. And everything was propaganda, posters, clothing, songs.
The East is red. The sun has risen. China has given rise to a Mao Zedong.
Scott Seligman is a Washington, D.C. writer who lived for several years in China.
On behalf of the people, he has brought good fortune to the people. He is the great savior of the people.
The original song was actually about love and food.
That's Sasha Gong, a former Chinese political dissident and Scott's friend.
It was about cabbage hearts, as a matter of fact. And then a very patriotic, somewhat obsequious Chinese man wrote new lyrics to it that sang the praises of Chairman Mao.
Sasha and Scott met several years ago and collaborated on writing projects. When they would get together, they ended up in Scott's kitchen, cooking and talking about Sasha's experience growing up during the Cultural Revolution. At one point, Scott suggested the two of them turn her memories and culinary skills into a book, The Cultural Revolution Cookbook.
She thought I was crazy.
I said, those are painful memories to me, but as long as I can add some stories in it, yeah.
Sasha has lived in the U.S. since 1987, and she got a Ph.D. from Harvard. But her childhood in China was a hard one.
I was 10 when the Cultural Revolution was launched. My grandfather was accused of being a counter-revolutionary, so I was sent to countryside living in the village.
Sasha and her family worked on farms, but the food all went to the government. Her family, like so many others, was left to fend for itself, and Sasha learned to cook with whatever she could find. In the cookbook, she shares the peasant recipes of that time and how food kept families together despite a revolution that was pulling them apart.
We're making no apologies for the Cultural Revolution in this book. It was a horrible time. A lot of people suffered. This is a celebration of the people who triumphed through this horrible time when there wasn't enough food and there wasn't freedom and all those awful things were happening. But somehow they managed to make do with what they had. They made remarkably tasty dishes with very, very basic and rudimentary materials and ingredients.
Ingredients anyone can get. No need to find a specialty Chinese market. These culinary delights are as close as your local supermarket. Sasha and Scott take me shopping for ingredients to cook up three classic Chinese dishes.
All right, let's grab a cart.
Okay, we need scallions and cilantro.
Tofu.
I think we're going for pork shoulder now.
Just get the soy sauce, any soy sauce.
Ginger.
Sesame oil.
Eggs.
We don't need to buy sugar. We don't need to buy salt. And we don't need to buy a stick of cinnamon, but we need some wine.
And Coca-Cola. That's it. How much was it?
$40.97.
$40.97. So for $40, not bad.
And the meal will feed about six people. And with that, we're off to Scott's apartment to put their simple recipes to the test.
All right, so what tools do we need to cook?
Well, actually,
dishes?
There's a cookbook out there that has something like 40 pages devoted to how to select, season, and choose a wok. We have about a paragraph on that. Because in the countryside, you cooked with it whatever the hell you had.
Yeah.
We actually are going to use a flat bottom pan today as well as a wok. It's really not that big a deal.
Remind us what we're cooking today, Sasha.
Actually, we are cooking braised pork.
With soy sauce.
With soy sauce.
And now I'm going to cut up the meat.
Okay.
This is pork shoulder, very much marbled. So, cut it through. Cut it through. See? Very easy to cut it through.
Kind of big chunks.
Big chunks.
Next, Sasha takes a large ginger root, skin on, and places it on the counter. She smashes it with the side of her meat cleaver.
Now, you turn on the stove. The pork is fatty, so you don't need much oil, but you do need oil to, well, smooth the pan.
Sasha then drops the ginger in the pan, and a sweet aroma fills the kitchen. And then in goes the pork to sear. Then she adds sugar, soy sauce, rice wine, and a stick of cinnamon.
And then we turn the fire into low medium. We let it cook.
How long does it cook for?
About 45 minutes. And it's important not to spend too much time.
That was important in selecting these dishes. You wanted them to be things that were easy?
Chinese restaurant food, a lot of what you see here in the United States, even at better Chinese restaurants, is a much prissier operation than this. This was country cooking. This was get it in the pot and heat it up and get it in everybody so that they've got enough strength to go work in the fields.
Yeah. And still tasty.
Right.
And this, we should say, you write in the book, was Chairman Mao's favorite dish?
Oh, yes. And Mao developed the habit when he was commanding the army in the Civil War.
Hmm.
He believed meat was good for your brain. So each time he was before a big battle, said, okay, cook me the braised meat with soy sauce and I need my brain food.
This is such a painful time. I don't imagine there are a lot of fond memories that you associate with this period of time. Focusing on it, writing a book about it, must have been strange.
Well, I went through a lot of bad time. But, you know, one thing about human beings, they always survive and celebrate life. And food is one of the major ways to do that.
There's a complicated sense of nostalgia in her recollections of that chapter. Scott says that's not unusual for her generation. Now, far enough away from the Cultural Revolution to look back on the small moments worth remembering.
In the last 20 years or so, China has seen a resurgence in some ways of interest in the Cultural Revolution. There are Cultural Revolution-themed restaurants in just about any large city in China. And these are places where people who were sent down to the countryside go, in some cases, to have reunions with others who were sent to the same places. And they relive their past. It's not a happy past entirely, but that's really not the point. It's their past.
Well, thank you very much for cooking with me and sharing this part of your history with me. Thank you to Scott.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Letting us into your home.
Oh, it's my great pleasure.
Before we leave, we ask Sasha if she remembers any of the music from that era. She says yes. That song, "The East is Red," is seared into her memory. But she refuses to sing the communist lyrics. She wants to sing us the original version about love and food. Again, Sasha Gong, choosing to remember her past her way.
芝麻油白菜心要吃豆角嘛炒 Sesame oil and cabbage heart. When you prepare string beans, you have to take out the string. If I don't see you for 3 days, I miss you to death. You're my dear, dear lover.
To try your hand at some of Sasha and Scott's recipes from the Cultural Revolution Cookbook, go to our website, npr.org.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. Culturetopia is produced by Mike Katziff and executive produced by Sarah Sarazen. I am Netta Ulibi.
Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.